Hey everyone, and welcome to this special soapbox edition of the Risky Business Podcast. My name's Patrick Gray. These soapbox podcasts we run here at Risky.biz are wholly sponsored affairs. Everyone you hear in a soapbox podcast paid to be here. The idea is vendors give us money, then they get to come onto this podcast and chat about their products, what their stuff does, the thinking behind it, the threat environment, so on and so on and so on. And today we're going to hear from Justin McCarthy of StrongDM. StrongDM is a bit of a niche player. Essentially what they do is they make a product that provisions secure access to engineers who need to access various back-end services. So you can think of them as like an identity-aware proxy of sorts, but for engineers. So instead of, you know, provisioning regular users with access to web applications like a typical identity-aware proxy, a StrongDM user will use the product to get access to like the production database or to Kubernetes or even SSH, right? And this serves, their stuff serves as a central choke point that does a whole bunch of logging, which is useful for compliance purposes. And I believe you can even apply some controls as well at their sort of hop point. And yeah, since the COVID crisis kicked off, business has gone pretty berserk for StrongDM. StrongDM co-founder and CTO Justin McCarthy joined me for this interview. And I started off by asking him if their recent success hinges on the fact that engineers in a lot of places aren't allowed into their offices, so they can't access the production site via the site-to-site VPN, which is, you know, normally how they'd access their production environment. And yeah, here's what Justin McCarthy had to say.
Yeah, it's exactly that. So so as much as theoretically, you know, VPNs were always available to their constituency, to their user group, in practice, they were heavily reliant on the site-to-site that was running from the office. Yeah. There are also plenty of offices that still have a rack or two of stuff in it. And that stuff also tended to have some sort of access pattern associated with it that they were relying on. So yeah, a lot of teams now have just vastly larger groups to provision on for remote access, and then there's layers of that, right? And so one thing about our product is that it tends to collapse some of those layers because a lot of the credentialing and the VPN can sort of be accomplished in one stroke.
So look, I think it would make sense to explain to the listeners what it is that you actually do at this point, because, you know, you've been on the show once before, and that was a snake oilers like a while ago, right? So why don't you just explain to the listeners, what StrongDM does?
Sure. StrongDM manages and audits remote access to your servers and databases and clusters. And the way we do that is by implementing an identity-aware proxy. There are a lot of identity-aware proxies out there. There are a lot of cloud access brokers out there. Our specialization is those low-level protocols that you're going to use to actually get to systems at the lower level.
Yeah, I mean, we got to make that distinction clear, right? So we had one of the Akamai guys on, and he was talking about his identity-aware proxy. Now, what he's talking about is pushing enterprise apps out to users. That is absolutely not what you do. You push SQL access out to engineers.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
So generally, if we look at our typical end user, it's somebody that has, you know, the word engineer somewhere near their title. So it could be a data scientist, it could be a member of DevOps, it could be a software engineer. But one way or another, they have a valid case for getting access to basically direct database access, direct access to a Kubernetes cluster, direct access to a set of Linux hosts. And those are all the use cases that are right down the fairway for us.
And the way that you implement this, I mean, essentially you get the users to install an agent, which then starts popping these services up on localhost, more or less, right? That's how it works.
Yeah, yeah. And the way to think of it, there are a lot of systems also that grant access that have an agent component, but it's often an agent that's running sort of on the destination. So from the point of view of the destination database or the destination server, our product is agentless. But that actually begins with a client that's, yeah, definitely installed in the user workstation. There's just a lot more you can say about the device of origin in that case. There's a lot more that you can say, and there's a lot more that you can deliver in the user experience. It's just more convenient for the user.
Yeah.
we bind to their existing directory or single sign-on. So it just seems like one authentication gesture. But then depending on their role, they get access to the whole collection of servers that they need to do their job.
So Justin, you know, you provision access to these protocols, but we haven't really drilled down into what they are apart from, you know, me giving examples of SSH and SQL. What protocols do you actually let people plumb through just so they can they can have an idea?
So we're adding protocols all the time, and the way to think about the order in which we're adding them is we're adding them according to you're sitting down as a data scientist, you're sitting down as a member of DevOps, and you need to get to something. The things that you most urgently need to get to, that's what we're adding. So we did start out heavily in databases. So as a result, we have a ton of depth there. So from things that feel like traditional databases, like Postgres to MySQL, but also things that feel like a little bit different, a little bit not a common thing that people see every day, like maybe Presto or Druid. And then actually the commercial databases that are very common, for example, in analytics like Teradata or Sybase IQ. And those are very sort of old binary protocols. And if you imagine what's involved there, it's going through byte by byte and handling every packet they send.
Do you build out, features and add additional protocols at customers' requests if there's enough of them, or how does that work?
Yeah, all the time. So we have the process of essentially parsing wire protocols. We have it down to a science. And so what that means is as soon as we see a few customers that have a desire to have a particular system proxied by us, they begin the conversation. And we begin the development process, and eventually it just pops up in the product. And you can now proxy access to your Kubernetes cluster or to your Azure, your AKS cluster.
That is the difference between you and an identity aware proxy in the web sense, right? Because they really develop that stuff starting with web, and you really develop this starting with whatever binary protocol you started with, right? It's just a completely different starting point.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But like I said, because we've gotten good at it, it's sort of a
regular. No, I get it. It'd be like mowing the lawn. Can you do this one? Yeah, sure. And you will have the whole process for that, right? You're not going to be sitting there brainstorming in that first meeting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. It's a very comfortable thing. And the result is just really beautiful to see, because if you think about there's no other way to see in the same moment, in the same session, that this person, ran this SSH command, ran this Teradata query, had this, conducted this RDP session, and then visited Jenkins. And that's all in one unified log in our system.
Yeah, no, that's pretty handy. It's funny, right? Because, you've developed this product, and its whole purpose is to authenticate engineers, and provide some sort of auditability, which you're not going to get on a free-for-all site-to-site VPN, right? But this thing is also completely, because you're going down to authenticating individual engineers instead of it just being a free-for-all, it doesn't really matter where the engineers are. So essentially, what you've developed here is the access solution for the coronavirus crisis, right? Although, was work from home really something that you had in mind when you put this thing together, or is that just a nice side effect? Because it feels like mostly it's just a nice side effect.
Yeah, I would say it's a nice side effect. And actually, prior to this surge in work from home, I would say actually the more dominant topic was I have an existing data center and I'm moving to Azure. I have an existing data center and I'm moving to AWS, or I have GCP and AWS in the mix and I need to bridge these environments. So actually, it was a lot more about multi-cloud and providing unified access to multi-cloud.
Uniform access and auditing and provisioning, right?
Exactly. Form source of access as well. Right, yeah, which, as you know, is a big tenet, of course, of the Zero Trust and Beyond Corp sort of point of view.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. The other day we did a bit of a prep call for this, and I asked you if you were at all interested in turning StrongDM into something that was more a generic tool that could be used by the average corporate user to access corporate applications. You're not really interested in doing that. Can you explain to us why?
Sure thing. I think just like anyone else that's building a product or a company, I think focus begets virtue. And so in this case, we know our mission isn't accomplished until until everybody with a technical role, it could be even an analyst in marketing that again needs to sort of directly access data, but somebody with a real technical case is provisioned through our product. So that's where our focus is going to remain for the next several years, for sure.
Yeah. Now, another thing that you can do is you can actually set alerting, right? So that if you've got an engineer who starts dumping too much data out of a database, for example, you can actually pump an alert out to a seam. Is that an often requested feature?
Yeah, absolutely. People, you know, every protocol, every use case, and every role is a little bit different. But the idea for our identity aware proxy is that one thing that it yields is it yields very legible output that's more than just Patrick had a session from point A to point B, right, in time. So it's getting very much into the content of that session. In the case of databases, it's obviously elements about the queries that Patrick is executing. In the case of an SSH interactive session, it's all the keystrokes and all the commands that are executed in that session. And that's exactly the kind of input into a seam that that is very rich, and it's much more rich than the corresponding version you'd get from, for example, TCP dump, right?
Well, yeah, especially given you're not going to be able to see quite a lot with TCP dump. I mean, you know, that's, I guess, one... Look, I'd imagine some of your customers are buying it just for the auditing alone, right? Because to be able to have... you know, a record of keystroke by keystroke every single SSH session in your production environment from every single engineer running through one appliance or one, you know, one single choke point. I mean, that's the purchase order right there for a lot of them. Is that right?
Yeah, I think that's right, especially where there's a compliance forcing function.
Yeah.
So what I'll also say is that the day-to-day, the act of provisioning and deprovisioning, that's where a lot of the work is, right? So that's where the work savings is happening. When we can take this whole group of data scientists or even add a bunch of summer interns to the data science team, right? They might have, you know, access to 20 different systems, right? That's one gesture in our product, okay? Yeah. So that's where a lot of the time savings comes from. But to the sort of the purchase order, as you say, it very much helps to know that there's a forcing function from compliance.
Well, okay, so, you know, you're talking about how much work it is to provision the interns. You know, at most places, I'm thinking realistically, they're just going to create a user called intern, probably over-provision it with access and then let them all go nuts, right? I mean, it's not that they're actually going to do the work to provision individual accounts to everyone. They're just going to YOLO it. I mean, that's got to be the experience, right?
I will say that across the industry, I would say there are some fairly common themes.
You may have seen that. Yeah, well, let's talk about those themes, right? Because everybody knows that you can do it well, but everybody also knows that it's not usually done well, right? That's the way I see this sort of access provisioning is like, you know, people start their first day and it's like, well, how do we access the production site? You know, this box. And it's like, you know, oh, the passwords are all up there on the whiteboard sort of thing, right? Like it often is that. But what are you seeing as the most common horrifying things out there in enterprise land?
So here, I'm going to use an example just from my history, which actually gets at the genesis of the StrongDM product in the first place. In my history, I was always the one saying either no or yes to the provisioning request, right, in previous roles, right? And so if you say no, then that's no fun, and there's an emotional cost to that. But if you say yes, you say yes knowing that you're doing it in an imperfect way. So there's some sort of shame that builds up with that, right? So I'd say is that one way of being able to say yes without shame, I think that is something that I know every time we add someone to the team and we provision someone in our product, we feel like we're not cutting corners and it just feels better.
Yeah.
There's no summer intern account.
There's no summer intern account. So let's talk about how the provisioning works, right? Because... you know, what does your gateway, because it is a gateway essentially, right, that you install in your production environment, right? And then you're proxying everything through it, whether that's SSH or, you know, Kubernetes stuff or SQL, right? So does your thing have like full database access and then the level of access is determined by the gateway? So, you know, you've basically just got an all-powerful, you know, database account that then gets turned down by the gateway. Is that how the provisioning works?
There are a couple of different provisioning models, and it really, of course, depends on how a customer tends to already create the underlying credentials. So to use an example, I would say a significant percentage of our customers already rely heavily on automation, right? So there's already some Terraform, there's already some CloudFormation going on. So what we tend to do is we tend to piggyback on those existing credential establishment.
Okay. So you are actually creating real accounts for each account that authenticates to your device.
Yeah, and then we're ingesting them into the system, and then we're basically governing access to those.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. So let's talk more horror stories, man. The punters love horror stories. What else have you got, right?
Okay, really, I would just say it's like maybe visiting a doctor. Okay. The doctor's sort of seen it before, and so you don't have to hide your story from the doctor. We're in a similar position where there's really no limit to the amount of ways that passwords might be saved in plain text. Passwords might be reused. It's the same story as any time you talk about a password management or any kind of credential vaulting. So I'll just say that remains the case out there in the world. And being able to have something to move toward, I think, is a relief to everyone.
Yeah. Now, one of the challenges that I've heard about from another vendor was that, okay, say you want to get this new thing going, actually getting access to the building if you've got to install this into a data center, that's actually been kind of challenging lately through this crisis because you're just not allowed to go into the buildings. Have you come up against that at all?
We haven't encountered problems with that, but mostly because where our gateway can deploy is pretty flexible. So as long as there was a jump host, a bastion, or a DMZ that already existed, if there's at least a little bit of virtualization that's going on, and you can add one more VM inside that DMZ,
and you can do that remotely, so you don't need to.
Yeah, then we're able to turn on the gateway, and that was a big part of the design of that aspect of the deployment. We knew that the gateway, the proxy itself, had to be very cross-platform, supportive of multiple deployment models. You can throw it in your Kubernetes cluster. You can throw it in your VM. You can run it on a vanilla box, no problem.
So there seems to be two things that are happening right now because of this crisis, right? You've got the people who are doing it right, okay? So they're going out to these vendors who are actually doing useful, helpful stuff, and they're trying to think about provisioning access, right? So that's one thing that they're doing, and they're doing it the right way. Then there's the others. So there's actually three ways people are doing it. Then there's the other ones who are just throw the doors open and then sort of gradually start locking it down as they can. And that's been the only way that they could continue. And then there's the third case, which is just people being like complete idiots and just springing up RDP sessions with crazy defaults and like whatever. What are you seeing most of out there? And I'm guessing you would be seeing a combination of the people who sprung up work from home very early in a sensible way. You'd see a combination between those people and the people who did it the YOLO way and are now trying to lock it down. I mean, is that about right?
Yeah, I think that is about right. We sort of always had a steady supply of people who were sort of already on some virtuous path, and this is just the next extension of that. And like I said, those are the teams that have a lot of automation in place already, right?
Yeah.
And because we're integrating with those environments, it's a very natural fit. So your Terraform apply just takes care of the whole thing. For the teams that have maybe some legacy, maybe some more traditional background, you know, like I said, inevitably they were on some migration path anyway, right? So this is just accelerating some of those phases, and so it may be, for example, like one initiative might be to just reduce the amount of VPN provisioning that's being done, period, right? Because there's just, you know, the traditional VPN, for whatever reason, the concentrators that are in place are, for whatever reason.
Man, I think this is really funny, right? Because I think this is the year that people really realized VPNs are a pretty dumb way to handle your business. You know, it really is that why, because we've got other technology now. I mean, you've got, in the case of trying to get applications to end users, the problem is everything's geared towards web, right? When you're talking about identity aware proxies for, you know, the average corporate user, if it's not a web product, you can sort of glue something together if it's thick client or whatever, but it's usually pretty ugly and it's going to work most of the time. Is sort of how I feel that's going to go. Is that an accurate assessment, do you think?
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think that's been a big part of, because of course we do, our product does support HTTP traffic as well.
Yeah. But so you're going for a different market. You're not trying to get people's SAP. to their home computer, right? Like you're trying to get that actual low-level access, which is, you know, harder in a lot of ways, right? It's a harder game, but it's specialist and that's what you're doing. But it just feels like VPN. I mean, but both of these things, IDAware proxies for the average corporate user and the stuff that you're selling, they both do the same thing, which is to replace a VPN. It's like there's this entire, you know, specialist industry popping up just to replace them. You know what I mean?
Yep. Yeah, absolutely. So I think what we noticed early on is that the way you think through a networking product versus the way you think through a human access product, just end up being very different. And a lot of VPNs feel more like networking products rather.
Well,
than
they are. I mean, they connect point to point, right? Which is cool, right? Okay, but like that's not how we do things anymore.
Yeah.
You don't authenticate just to get access to a network segment. That's, you know, and then what? You kick them out there and just let them run around, do whatever they want. That's insane.
Yes. Yeah. It's also like there's a little bit of heritage bundled in there with sort of performance anxieties, let's say. So like there's, you know, is the proxy going to add latency? Is it going to slow down the users? And you know, in 2020 and beyond, these proxies can be very fast. They can use very little memory. And yet they can retain all the promises that you get from being able to know that, you know, it's Justin or Patrick authoring these bytes.
Well, and the other thing is people, you know, getting owned sideways by other, you know, kind of legacy approaches, right? So you look at Citrix gateways now, so many people getting owned by ransomware crews because of unpatched Citrix gateways and whatever, and Pulse Secure VPN. And I think there's a Fortinet one as well. And just, I mean, that's an absolute horror show. So do you think we will actually see an acceleration of the demise of the VPN as a mainstay of corporate IT? Because it sort of feels like this could be the beginning of the end for the VPN.
Yeah, one thing that the I think because VPN was as far as we can tell, it was rarely a revenue center. So it was always an add-on to an existing purchase that you're making. VPNs in general have not been maintained with the same fervor as some of the other product lines.
Yeah, they're like an afterthought, like an additional component of whatever border device you bought from Cisco or whoever, right?
Yes. Yeah. So I do think that it's, you know, there's also an opening in the market for somebody to say, slam their fist on the table and say, I'm going to make it good.
I'm going to make a good VPN. God damn it.
Yeah.
How do you make a good VPN, right? Like, because this is the thing, we don't connect people via, oh, you're on the network, so you're okay. Right. Like that's the thing that's changed. It just seems crazy now, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, I would say that's the reason why we don't describe our product that way.
Now, look, there is one thing that we got into the other day that I want to ask you about, you know, in the recording, which is I wondered why your product doesn't actually put like query limits on users, right? Because, okay, a big risk of the VPN is, say, as an attacker, I can get onto one of your engineers' computers, I can piggyback on their VPN access and I can run wild, right? So that's like, that is a bit of a security threat. Under your system, right, I can get onto your engineer's, say I get onto your engineer's computer, I can do whatever that engineer can do, and all of that is going to be logged, right? And I might generate some alerts. But what's to stop me dumping the whole database and running away with it? You tell me that in the future, you will have the capability to do those sort of query limits. But, and this is the part that I found interesting, you've said that most customers aren't really interested in that as a feature. Why is that, do you think?
Sure. I would say that during the early phases of considering the product, of rolling out the product, that's a discussion topic. It just hasn't hit the top of the board yet. I do think we have that feature coming in the future, and I'll point out just one aspect of our architecture. You should think of really every stream that's going through the system, every byte of every stream at any moment, our code can intercede and decide to shut down the connection. Right.
Yeah.
So there's no lag, there's no latency. It is a real time evaluation.
But that's what I mean. Like, it's clear that that's the case. So I would have thought that would make sense, where you've got someone who, you know, usually they're using X bytes of database access in a day, and all of a sudden, you know, after about the fourth gigabyte, you might say, whoa, hey, you know, and shut them down.
Yeah, so I would say that smells a lot like the kinds of product complications you get into with tuning systems in general, right? Because is it 4 bytes or 4 megs or 4 gigs? Is it this query followed by that query?
And then there's the day that the big migration happens, or they have to do this or have to do that, and then it's normal, and you've just completely ruined a massive project at a critical moment because the engineers didn't know that these limitations were going to kick in. I mean, that could be a thing that happens, right?
Yep. On the other hand, you know, a system that did clamp shut aggressively, like you could have one aggression slider that maybe would be okay, and then you could remediate some of that with some, for example, two factor, right? Or even some peer to peer two factor, right? So if team member A is doing it, at least team member B can get a notification push okay.
Yeah.
So those are the kinds of patterns that seem very believable and don't have the same smell as the tuning as getting lost in tuning forever.
So that's sort of signed by a second party, right? Like I sort of think of it as MFA countersigning. Is any of that in your product at the moment? Because there's another company that I know where they allow restrictions to be put on who can run a sudo command on, you know, a Linux box. Anytime someone tries to sudo anything, it actually sends, like, via Duo push, an alert to the actual admin of that box who can see the command and choose whether to allow or deny it. And I just think that sort of that countersigning of sensitive instructions and commands is interesting. Are you doing any of that in the product already?
Yeah, so we certainly do, and we enjoy the push MFAs. So we integrate directly with Duo for exactly that reason.
Yeah.
In terms of the countersigning piece, we tend to do that. Like we have a version of that we have implemented in-house on top of our API. So sort of like the dual key launch code sort of verification. Right? So we do that via a little bit of chat ops just through our own API.
Okay.
So we provide enough hooks that any team that cared to do that would be able to build it no problem.
So when are you kicking up engineers to MFA prompts? Because, you know, clearly that's something you're doing. Like when what is the trigger point for that?
Yeah. So you have a few dials on, idle timers, basically session idle timers. And that's kind of a deep notion of idle. So like, it depends on how many bytes are flowing through your RDP or SSH or Postgres session. Right. And so there are those kind of things. And then there's also, there are different sort of device location changes. If the IP warps across the planet faster than light speed would allow.
Faster than planes go. Yeah.
Yes.
Although, I mean, you know, we saw, and that's the thing. And the reason you prompt for an MFA and you don't just kill the session. I don't know if you remember this. This is some years ago now. There were reports that that Russian government hackers had attacked a dam in the United States, and it turned out to be one of the guys who worked for that dam was actually in Russia on holiday and just remembered that he forgot to do something, so he logged in, valid creds, started tuning something, and that's so funny because we spent so long, you know, convincing the world not to do attribution based on IPs. And then this was only a few years ago, off they went. So that's, so an MFA prompt seems to be the agreed industry standard, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. And I'll say, like, that's where push, and I would say even push in many ways is superior to some of the other, just for the specific use case, just because your mobile device is going to grab your attention in a way that a YubiKey couldn't, right?
Yeah. Okay. So we've been over the basics of how all of this works, what it's for, who's going to use it. But look, you've got some news as well in terms of recent additions you've made to the, or recent developments you've added to the product. You're very excited about your new API.
Yeah. I'll say I'm excited mostly because for years I was the one saying coming soon. And so I had to be on the front lines promising any minute now. But we did launch the API recently here, and what that the reason we had a lot of pent up demand was because we had many customers and I thank them for their support, but using our CLI, sort of just essentially having shell scripts that would manually invoke functions that would at the end of provisioning a server, they'd call a CLI command on us.
That's not the way we do things anymore, Justin. Come on.
that's not the way you do things anymore. Yeah. So thankfully we now have SDKs in all the major languages, and we have a beautiful Terraform provider so that really it's true of most of our customers, all of their provisioning, their machine instantiation is happening through, one of those automated provisioning systems anyway. And so now the final registration step just feels totally native. Your systems are registered in StrongDM and you can begin accessing them immediately.
So who's embraced, how long's the API been out, and has anyone sort of jumped on it already? And because usually what happens is you pump out an API like this and people start doing stuff with it that you had no idea they would. And no, you know, you just absolutely did not intend for them to use it that way. But, you know, it's, hey, it's their API now. So yeah, when did it come out, and what are people using it to do?
Sure. I think the official launch was, let's see, what are we in May now? So the official launch was really just last month. And so so folks are just, I would say our existing customers are migrating their existing sort of like hack together scripts into something that feels more like real Python code or real code. So that's maybe kind of boring. That's kind of the expected stuff. Where we're, I think, really excited is just more and more chat ops and more sort of custom integrations and custom integrations to other workflows. So that, you know, we have a lot of traffic that goes on in our Slack where people are requesting access, and essentially the system of bots are approving it, and it's just a really legible record of what's going on with the system, and that's all made possible by a really well-designed API.
It's funny, right, man? Because, you know, chat ops is just one of those things that, I mean, how much of the world's important computing infrastructure is run by Slack these days, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
All right, Justin, before we wrap this thing up, who do you most want to hear from, right? Because I'd imagine already there would be some listeners who would be quite interested to go take this out for a hoon. First of all, I imagine you do a free trial.
Yeah, absolutely. Anyone can show up, kick the tires for 2 weeks, and we're standing by to help. Anyone can reach out at any time, sign up for a trial, and we'll be there to help out and answer questions live as well.
Excellent. And who are you most interested, do you think, in hearing from? Who's having the most success? If you had to pick the ideal customer who's going to get the best result, who is that person?
So the ideal customer is one that has that is on the path to automation. So they're on the path. They may not be finished with their Terraform or CloudFormation. They may not consider it done, but they're on the path. They maybe have more than just a simple case. So they have maybe two clouds involved, maybe multiple regions, geographic regions involved, multiple geographic regions of end user involved, and a team that's like of a decent size and growing. A lot of what you're saving is you're saving time and anxiety around granting access to groups of people. And so the bigger the group, the more anxiety you're saving.
All right, Justin McCarthy, thank you so much for joining us on the Soapbox to have a good chat about StrongDM. It's been a lot of fun. Cheers.
All right, Patrick. Thanks. Take care.
That was Justin McCarthy of StrongDM there, and you can check them out at strongdm.com. Big thanks to StrongDM for sponsoring this edition of the Soapbox podcast, and big thanks to Justin McCarthy for finding the time to speak with me. And that is it from me this week. I'll be back next week with more risky business. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.